See, today I'll be reading from the English Standard Version, Luke 5, 1-11. On one occasion, while the crowd was pressing in on him to hear the word of God, he was standing by the lake of Gennesaret, and he saw two boats by the lake, but the fishermen had gone out of them and were washing their nets. Getting into one of the boats, which was Simon's, he asked him to put out a little from the land. And he sat down and taught the people from the boat. And when he had finished speaking, he said to Simon, "Put out into the deep and let out your nets for a catch." And Simon answered, "But master, we toiled all night and took nothing. But at your word, I will let down the nets." And when he had done this, they enclosed a large number of fish, and their nets were breaking. And they signaled to their partners in the other boat to come and help them. And when they came and filled the boats, so they had begun to sink. But when Simon Peter saw it, he fell down at Jesus' knees, saying, "Depart from me, for I am a sinful man, O Lord." For he and all who were with him were astonished at the catch of the fish they had taken. And so also were James and John, sons of Zebedee, who were partners with Simon. And Jesus said to Simon, "Do not be afraid. From now on, you will be catching men." And when they had brought their boats to land, they left everything and followed him. Well, this morning's message Dr. Urbino will be sharing will be from this passage here, and it's entitled "Gone Fishing." And Dr. Urbino, good to have you back.
Let me start by saying I'm not much of a fisherman, so there we go. We'll just get that out of the way right away. And what I'm going to talk about may not be what you normally hear from this passage, but you've come to expect that from me, I think, not what you normally hear. And not what you normally hear, because for those who haven't figured it out, this passage is actually in the New Testament. I've read it. Once or twice. And instead of Hebrew, we're going to talk about Greek today. So there you go. So something new all around. Newness, transition, change. Over at Golden Gate Seminary, which won't be Golden Gate Seminary in about a month, we are in great transition. We are in great transformation. If you were to go over there now, you would see empty hallways and boxes in the hallways and offices of faculty that say empty, and things are just in an uproar. We're still teaching students, or at least some of us are still making noises that we call teaching students, but this is the last week, and then in a couple of weeks, Golden Gate will cease from here. It will move down. And it will suddenly, after the Southern Baptist Convention on the 14th or 15th of June, suddenly magically reappear, transformed as Gateway Seminary down in Ontario. So on the back of your bulletin, this will probably be the last time it says professor at Golden Gate. But you guys are used to that because you went through a transition of name at least not too long ago when I first came. You had a different name. I started preaching at this church when it was a different church. So transformation happens, and transformation can be external, it can be internal. You can change your name and still maintain who you are. You can change who you are and still maintain your name. Transformation is ongoing. As Christians, we are also called to be transformed. Unlike Golden Gate's more superficial exterior transformations, we are called to be transformed from the inside out. Today, I want to have us look at two stories. We read one already. We'll get to another one. Two stories about fishing. And if you come to Sunday school, we'll have yet a third book about fishing. We'll talk about Jonah, which has a really big fish. But we'll get to that. Two stories about fishing. Two stories that illustrate transformation. We're going to take a look at the one we read in Luke, And then take a look at one in John. I usually don't go across books because the authors are doing different things, but I think here it really sets us up for a nice canonical understanding of transformation. So we'll see two different stories by two different authors, two different gospels, but both about transformation of a guy named Peter. We'll see this transformation, I think, from these texts. Would you pray with me? Our gracious God, teach us this day what you would have us become as the people of God. So we had read for us Luke chapter 5, verses 1 through 11. Luke chapter 5, that's very early in Luke's gospel. Luke's gospel has a whole bunch at the very beginning about the birth narratives. Chapter 3 is a genealogy. Chapter 4 begins Jesus' ministry with a fairly famous story. A couple of stories. I'll let you read chapter 4 at your leisure later. But it begins his ministry. He's becoming well known. He's doing amazing things. One of which was healing the mother-in-law of some guy named Simon. We're not really introduced to him. He's just there, Simon's mother-in-law. Now, we the readers, we know who this Simon is. But in the text, he just kind of pops on the scene. Actually, he's not even there. It's just his mother-in-law. We don't really get a picture of him. So when we get to chapter 5, that's really the getting going of Luke's story about Jesus. It's where the first disciples are called. This story is placed at the very start of Jesus' ministry, even though in chapter 4, we know it's not the beginning of Jesus' ministry. He's been doing stuff and been around for a while. So it's already been read for us, but let me read it again, and that way I can throw some Greek in and just have some fun with that. But let's see what's going on in this story. On one occasion, chapter 5, verse 1, following. On one occasion, while the crowd was pressing in on him to hear the word of God, so already Jesus is known as a teacher who teaches the word of God. So that's a fairly high mark. He's already done miracles. He's healed. He's cast out demons. So the people want to hear from this guy. He was standing by the lake of Gennesaret, the Sea of Galilee. Now, if you've been there at Capernaum, you've actually stood at the Sea of Galilee, and you can look across, and it's fairly shallow out for a little bit, and then it kind of drops off a bit more. But he's standing there, kind of hanging out, and the crowd is pressing him. You can almost see him being pushed towards the edge, pushed towards the water, which reflects what happened in chapter 4 when the people wanted to push him off a cliff. And now he's being pushed by people who like him, so much so that he's near the water, and he sees these two boats sitting there, and there's no fishermen in them. They had already gone out of the boats. They were done for the day, and they were washing their nets. You have to wash your nets off to make sure they don't get all crackly and bad. So they're washing their nets. They're done. And Jesus, you got to love this guy. Jesus simply walks over and gets into one of the boats, and it's Simon's boat. Simon, whose mother-in-law Jesus had healed. Yeah, you owe me something, Simon. Come on, get over here. Yeah, it's like, yeah, I'm in charge here. There's a real way that Jesus works in the Gospels. Yeah, he gets into one of the boats, and he says, Simon, boyo, let's go out a little bit from the land. I want to use your boat as a pulpit. I want to be able to talk. So now he gets in the boat, and if you want to see a first century boat, come on to Sunday school. I've got some slides, or you could talk to Rod. I know he saw one at Magdala when you were there. You saw the Jesus boat, I'm sure. Many of you may have. So he gets in the boat, sits down in the boat. It's a little bit out, and he starts teaching the people, sitting down in the boat. What did he say? I don't know what he said. The story doesn't care what he said. The story is moving on to after he's done. So the teaching here is irrelevant. Apparently, the word of God. but the teaching's irrelevant. But he was teaching. And after he's finished speaking, that's the next Greek word, it's just after he's done, he says to Simon, put out into the deep water and let your nets down for a catch. Do you have any idea what he just asked him to do? We generally go right to Simon, to Peter's response, but we'll get there in a minute. Well, we'll get there now. Simon says, Master, I don't know what your translations say there. This is a very rare word. It's used only 7 times in the New Testament, and it's used by Luke. And what it means is not master, it's an administrative title, as opposed to rabbi or, you know, teacher or something like that. This is an administrative title that was also used in the Hellenistic world for a rich person's tutor. So Aristotle for Alexander was this word, and this word is epistetas. There, now you know Greek. See, I've said it. So this is the word. It's an odd word. But basically the best translation here is tutor, teacher, guy who's teaching. Master for us has an implication that there's some sort of a relationship built. There isn't. He is calling him an administrative name that means teacher. It's a very standoffish sort of term for him to use. Teach. Teacher. We toiled all night and we took nothing. Yeah. Do hear that. And hear it as sarcastic and sardonic as you want. This is a guy who's a fisherman. It's what he does for a living. And this other guy who's a teacher, I get that a lot, who's a teacher, those who can do, those who can't teach. Yeah, you want me to do what? Really? Pal, we already did it. But, at your rhema, and that's the Greek word here, rhema, at your instruction, at your word is how it's often translated, it's your word, I'll let down the nets. Now, the next line indicates the trouble that it cost him. But here in this, that it's not an obedience built out of love or anything. This is an obedience built on something completely different. This is a sarcastic obedience. This is fearful of a big fat waste of my time, pal. But I know I owe you one, and heaven forfend that I insult the famous teacher in front of all these people. Yeah, you caught me. I'm going to have to do this. I want you to know you're wasting my time, pal, but I'm not going to insult your honor in front of all these people, so I'm going to do it. You hear? How do we know he's got this kind of verve to him? Well, we see a little bit later how he feels about it and the idea of this teacher word. Teach. Yeah, pal. This is a resistant obedience. A very resistant obedience. So what happens? The beginning of verse 4 should be a heck of a lot longer than it is. As it stands, it says, and when they had done this, do you realize what they just did in that little bit? They rowed back to the shore. They got their nets. They loaded their nets in the boat. They rowed back out. Then they rowed out to the deeper water. Then they cast their nets into the water, knowing full well that nothing was going to happen, and they were going to have to row back into the shore, take the nets back out of the boat, wash the nets off again. Thank you so much, but fine. We'll do it. When they had done this, that's all you get in the New Testament, they enclosed a large number of fish so that their nets were breaking. Surprise! Oh. Well, now it's not a waste of time. They had so many. Verse 7, they signaled their partners in the other boat to come out and help them. And they came and filled both boats so that they began to sink. Now notice the hyperbole. I mean, notice how the author is drawing that out. This was so many fish, it was sinking two 25-foot boats. This is a lot of fish. And you didn't think there was going to be any, Peter. And so the boats were about to sink, but when Simon Peter realized what was going on, remember, Jesus is still in the boat, apparently. Simon Peter walks over to him in the boat and just falls flat on his face, falls on his knees, at Jesus' knees, saying, "Leave me." What an odd remark. The whole set of Gospels is all about something quite the opposite. You're not supposed to want Jesus to leave you. And yet, that is how Peter responds. Get away from me. Because since a man, a sinner, am I. That's the Greek. A man, a sinner, am I. Oh, Lord. When he spoke to him earlier, it was, hey, teach. Now it's kurios in the Greek. It is Lord. It is master. It is one who is in charge. Do you hear the transformation of Peter in that? It is a partial transformation. Depart from me is still not transformed very much, but the idea that I get it. I saw this amazing thing. I realized, yeah, you are more than the guy that I was just insulting. And so you need to leave me because clearly I have dishonored you. Clearly I have done bad by you. Leave me. I'm a sinful man. Then we have kind of a side comment in the text, verse 9, and it tells you why he thought this way. Because he and all who were with him were, and I don't know what your translation is there, this word is only used three times in the Bible. This word, astonished, amazed, whatever your translation has there, it's only used three times, and it was last used, and it's only used by Luke. Luke in Acts once, and in this little section of Luke's gospel twice. In chapter 4, the people were amazed, astonished by the teaching of Jesus. Now, Peter and everybody with him is amazed, astonished at this miraculous thing that happened. Figure out a big word that you know for amazed and astonished, one that has you dumbfounded, gobstruck, beside yourself. Whatever word fits for you, that's the word here. It is, that's the word. That's a great word. You can spell that. That's what it is. That's what makes him realize. He is terrified of this guy. Leave me, get away from me, because clearly I've just insulted someone who deserves a lot more honor and it is, and I can't handle it. This is fear. Peter is now afraid of what's going on. From a shock that sheds light on just who we really are in the face of someone so awe-inspiring. He was amazed, astonished at the catch. Arrest, capture is this word, of fish that they had taken. And so also were James, you get this little sidebar in the sidebar, so also were James and John, son of Zebedee's, who were partner with Simon. Because this is ostensibly a story about the first disciples. So this shock and awe, to use a more modern term, makes them all realize, wow, and certainly Peter as representative, oi, what have I done? You better leave it's just stripping away the pretense and bravado that he had shown in his answer the first time. Yeah, I know fishing. You know healing and teaching, but I know fishing. And apparently Jesus knows fishing too. Fear because he is suddenly seen to be sinful, to be less than perfect, to be not right in the glaring light of God's glory. Remember Isaiah chapter 6. See, I had to bring in the Old Testament. Isaiah chapter 6, he's in the temple. He sees the Lord and he says, "Woe unto me, for I am an unclean man and I have unclean lips and I live among unclean people." The fear that that brings. Peter knows that he had insulted someone very important. And he might just have to pay for that. But notice Jesus' response. Jesus says to Simon, there at the end of verse 10, "Don't be afraid. You don't have to fear me. I'm not someone to be afraid of just because you're sinful. I already know you're sinful. Don't be afraid." How amazing is that? The turning of that fear into something else. And then immediately, as so often happens in the biblical text, "Don't be afraid." There's a joining in relationship. There's something going on. And immediately you get something to do. Immediately. Psychologists will tell you that's a great thing. When you're afraid, do something. Because the more you stand around and think about your fear, the more afraid you're going to get. And if you do something, you can move forward and your mind will be engaged somewhere else and you'll move outside of that fear. Here, what is the thing, the task, the assignment? From now on, you, second person singular, just to Peter right at this moment, you will be catching, and this is a different Greek word than the catch used earlier. This is another word, so many rare words in this story. This word is only used twice in the entire New Testament. Zograo, it's used here, you will be catching, to capture alive, to take into custody. The other place it's used is in 2 Timothy 2. So here, and I'll get to that in a second, you are catching alive these fish, these men, these humans. You're going to take custody of these humans to ostensibly do something good with them. In 2 Timothy chapter 2, it is the devil who catches men to do something bad to them. It's a wonderful, the fact that it's only used in those two places. And here is the call to Peter. You're going to be catching alive these men. That's what you're going to do. Here's where often the preaching on this passage ends. See, it's evangelism. Yeah, it is. But when seen in the light of another passage, it becomes so much more. Because notice what happens in verse 11. "And when they," Jesus speaks to Peter, and suddenly it's, "and when they had brought their boats to land, they left everything and did what? Followed him." Everybody say that nice and loud. That's it. Evangelism is an initiation. Following is a lifestyle. Following is everything. And that's the crucial piece. That's the end of the story. That's the point you get to. After all this happens, they are not afraid. They have a task and they follow. They follow Jesus. Where's he going? I don't know. I mean, I know because I've read the rest of the story. But here, they just follow. They drop everything and say, "Well, this is the guy we're going with. We're following him." Fear is quelled by a task, by an assignment. Don't be afraid. We're all sinful. And to use some of the biblical metaphor, we're all sinners in the hands of an angry God, as Jonathan Edwards once preached. Yeah, we are. How sad for us to maintain that when Jesus says, "Don't be afraid. Don't be afraid. Come unto me. Follow me. Don't be afraid." So in Luke's story, we can see the following progression, a kind of a minor transformation in Peter. Resistant, fearful obedience when he starts out, yeah, pal, I'll dump it over. Yeah, fine. Followed by fear because of the acknowledgement of sinfulness. I'm horrible. Which has the opposite effect that Jesus wants. Peter says, get out of town. Leave me. Stay away from me. And Jesus says, no, I want to be a friend. I want you to come. Follow me. How amazing. Fear because of sinfulness, and then fear is quelled by a word and an assignment. So, that's the first story. Told you we were going to look at two. There's another story about Peter and fishing at the very end of John's gospel. So flip open if you want. Well, actually, even if you don't want. No, flip open if you want to John chapter 20. We're going to start the chapter before because the last two verses of John chapter 20 tell us a lot about John chapter 21. Chapter 20, verse 30 and 31. Many other signs, therefore, this is after the resurrection, therefore Jesus also performed in the presence of the disciples, which are not written in this book. But these have been written that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and believing you may have life in his name. What does that sound like? I would argue that's the end of the gospel. You can hear the music crescendo at the end and the credits start to roll. That's the end. He's just told you exactly what he wants. I wrote all this down so that you could believe. Thank you so much for reading. And then there's chapter 21. Another ending? One might call it an epilogue. It's another chapter that's kind of not stuck on the end, but kind of stuck on the end. It's another chapter. Let's look at the chapter as a whole, starting from the end, because it's always very fun, to see why this chapter was stuck on the end. So if we start at verse 20 of chapter 21, we're going to start in the middle of a story, but it'll make sense, I hope. Peter turned and saw the disciple whom Jesus loved, John, the author of the gospel, saw the disciple whom Jesus loved following. Many of your translations will probably put the word them after that. It's not in the Greek. That's an attempt at an English following them to make sense. It's a bad attempt. Because the point of, if the author had wanted to put the word them, he could have put the word them. He left that word out. Because what is the disciple whom Jesus loved doing? Following. He's not following them, he's following. That's how we just left the last story. They dropped everything and they followed. Here we have John, the beloved, following. And then you have a parenthetical comment just to make sure that you don't confuse the beloved disciple with anybody else. It gives you a little bit of the backstory. He's the one who did this. When Peter, verse 21, when Peter saw him, he said, hey, what about him? Oh, Peter, you got to love Peter. He's always Peter. He just is. What about him? What's going to go on with him? And we'll see why he's responding that way. But he says, what about him? Jesus said to him, if it's my will that he remain until I come back, ostensibly, what do you care? What is that to you? You, anybody see it there at the end of that verse? You do what? You follow me. Ooh, a lot of this follow stuff going on here. You don't worry about you. And I think I've told you the story before. Me and my little brother, he would do something and I would do something and I'd get in trouble. And of course, my first comment was, what about him? And my mother, a good Christian woman, apparently having read this, said, what is it to you? I'll take care of him. You worry about you, pal. So, verse 23, the saying spread abroad among the brothers that this disciple was not to die, yet Jesus did not say to him he was not to die, but if it's my will that he remain, what is that to you? What in the world is that doing there? That's very crucial to knowing why this chapter's here. This is the, and we'll see how that fits in. Then it continues. This is the disciple who is bearing witness about these things, who has written these things, and we know his testimony is true. Now, there were many other things that Jesus did. Were every one of them to be written? I suppose the whole world could not contain the books that would be written. And that's exactly what we had seen at the end of the last chapter. So why is this chapter here? What is the focus at the end? You got two issues going on. One, apparently, everybody thought that John was not going to die until Jesus came back. And apparently, John is getting older and older and older and older and older to where people are really thinking he's not going to die. You'll remember in the early church, they thought Jesus' return was next Tuesday. Paul even has to apologize that some people have died. So in the early church, you have this thing going on where everybody knows about this saying of Jesus. And here is the corrective to it. John is saying, yeah, I may die, I may not, who knows, but don't think I get to live forever, even though it's been a long time and you're still waiting for Jesus to come back. By the way, he hasn't come back yet. And John is dead. Shh, don't tell anybody. So part of the purpose of this book is to quell that rumor, of this chapter, is to quell that rumor. Another aspect is, and you could see it in the material, to give legitimacy to the book. Here's the guy who wrote it. He's an eyewitness. You need to trust him. What is in this book is perfectly true. So apparently some others were asking other questions about, well, who wrote this thing? Can we? It's so different than the other three. Can we believe this one? And you've got this end that likely was perhaps added later to say, yes, you can. Yes, you can believe this book. Because here's the guy who wrote it, and he was the one who leaned on the breast of Jesus at the Last Supper. He was there. He saw it all. So if following is important, if the idea of he was there, and the return will come, as John says in the book of Revelation, the return comes soon. That's when it happens. It happens soon in the book of Revelation by John. Any day now, you need to maintain your following no matter how long you remain. That's part of this last section, this last chapter. But there's something else, something more about following that's in this chapter, which is what the readers were supposed to be doing, following along, being followers till Jesus returns. Let's look at the fishing story and see if we can see what the author is saying in his last boomf, in his last piece, in his main point, in his summary statement. He's now going to tell another fishing story about Peter. Wow, if you were choosing what story to put here, Would you put this one here? I think you would. Keep in mind that the other notice, that other than the notice that Peter and the faster beloved disciple, we've seen that, were told by Mary Magdalene of the empty tomb, and they confirmed it. That's the last time we saw Peter in this gospel. He was there, he ran, and he had a faster gospel. The beloved guy, John, is faster than Peter. If you were running a relay race, you need to know that. John is faster than Peter, and Peter makes it there, and Peter confirms the empty tomb. That's the last we've seen of him, and just before that was when he denied Christ three times before the rooster. We don't have, or maybe we will, have a giant forgiveness moment. Don't you expect that in the gospel? Peter and Jesus meet up, and Peter says, I am really sorry. We'll see if that happens. Because we've had the rooster, we have the tomb, and now we're going to have this fishing story. So, chapter 21, starting from the beginning, and we'll catch up to where we were. After this, the previous material, Jesus revealed himself again to the disciples by the Sea of Tiberias. How many names does this lake have? And he revealed himself in this way. Simon Peter, Thomas, called the twin, Nathanael of Cana in Galilee, the sons of Zebedee, and two others of his disciples. Really? You couldn't name them? I think there's a reason that you don't name them. First of all, one of them is the beloved. So there's, and we find that out later, there's really only one disciple that's left unnamed. Maybe at Sunday school we'll sing the Gilligan's Island theme song in both ways and see how that worked. Anyway, for those who know, we'll get there. They were together. Simon Peter says, I'm going fishing. Of course, it's what he knows how to do. He's kind of beside himself. Okay. They said, well, we'll go with you. They went out and got into the boat, this time just one boat. But that night they caught nothing. Sound familiar? Yes, you should be remembering the other story. Peter goes out fishing. He fishes all night. He catches nothing. The smart reader goes, oh, I remember this story. But it may not be the same story. As a matter of fact, it's not. Even though the details are put there so that you will catch the similarities. Just as day was breaking, Jesus stood on the shore, where we found him before. Yet the disciples did not know that it was Jesus, because they were about 100 yards off, and it's dawn, and who could see what? You know, Jesus said, and I like this, Jesus said to them, it makes it sound like he's talking right here. No, Jesus said to them, children, have you ever stood at the edge of a lake and seen somebody 100 yards out? You got to holler at them. Children, what a great word. It's very odd here, but it's very affectionate. Understandable from the reader's perspective. John also uses little children in his epistles to mean the community of faith. So the sharp reader makes this connection. Remember, nobody, that these guys in real life were not speaking Greek. Wherever your author puts a Greek word, your author makes a choice what Greek word to use there. I don't know what Aramaic word Jesus spoke to them. I know that John chooses the word children. And that word would have rang very clear for readers of all of John's works, understanding that this is a reference to all of the disciples in an affectionate form. Children, you got any fish? They answered, nope. Actually, they probably hollered it back. He said to them, this is all plural so far. Unlike the Luke story where it was all Peter until the very end, now it's all plural. He said to them, cast the net on the right side of the boat and you will find. It's not find some, it's just find. You will find in the Greek. Seek and you will find. Not find some, seek and you will find. You'll find, apparently, a bunch of fish. Very similar to Luke's story. You should be catching that. And so what do you expect, having read Luke's story? You expect Peter to pop up and say, hey, I'm not doing this again. Peter's not even in the story yet. I mean, he was the initiator, but he's not there yet. Remember the last time Peter was afraid and spoke hesitantly. If there's ever a time to be for Peter to be afraid of Jesus, if you thought insulting him in a crowd was something to be afraid of, denying him three times would be really something to be afraid of. But we don't get anything. So they cast it. They threw out the net. There's no discussion. There's no nothing. They may or may not even know it's Jesus. Matter of fact, they don't even know it's Jesus. What an odd story. Some guy on the shore says, throw it out there. Maybe they thought he saw something. I don't know. But they do it. No commentary, just obedience to someone they don't even know who it is yet. There's no fear in these disciples. Do you see that change? They're not afraid anymore. They should be. Romans might be after them. They denied Jesus. But even with all of that, they're not portrayed as being in fear. So they cast it, and now they were not able to haul it in because of the quantity of fish. If you thought there were a lot of fish last time, we're going to get more details this time. The result is the same, but now you, the reader, are probably, you should be asking yourself, well, what about Peter? What's up with him? He was the star of the story last time. He's not even really been in it this time. That disciple whom Jesus loved therefore said to Peter, it is Kurios, it is the Lord. This is kind of relationship that the latter part of the gospel portrays between John and Peter. They seem to have some sort of a friendly rivalry. They race to the tomb. They're dealt with in tandem. A certain superiority in the gospel of John over Peter. If you read it, you can kind of see that the gospel, the disciple whom Jesus loved is always just a little bit better than Peter. Faster, gets it first. So when Peter asks about John that we saw already, what about this guy? It fits very well with that little friendly rivalry between them. Yeah, what about this guy? He's been nipping at my heels and I've been nipping at his heels. What are we doing here? Perhaps dealing in the gospel with leadership and authority issues in the early church. John is writing to deal with that. Perhaps that's another aspect that the epilogue seeks to solve. But either way, it is John who figures it out. John tells Peter, and notice what Peter does this time. This is a transformed Peter. When Simon Peter heard that it was the Lord, he tied around himself. That's what it says. They say put on. No, it doesn't. It's he tied around himself. Another rare Greek word. John is the only one to use it, and it's only used elsewhere when Jesus ties around himself the towel at the Last Supper as a movement towards service. The Greek is very instructive here. The word used is that he ties himself up for service, his outer garment, because he was naked. And some of you will say, he stripped down for work. No, the word there is just he was naked. He had nothing. And yet he ties around him something that imitates, I'm ready for service. And what does he do? If your Bible says he jumps in the water, cross it out. He throws himself, or whatever word was used earlier for the disciples casting the net into the water. It's the same word. He casts himself. He becomes the net. He has taken on himself to be the fisher of men, to serve like Jesus served. He is all in. Notice that it doesn't say, and he swam to shore, because that's not the point of the text. The text is to show you a transformed Peter who is now girding up, as Jesus girded up the towel, he's girding up, and he is throwing himself fully into the work, casting himself as the very net for bringing in the captured people. What an amazing transfer. And there's no snide comment. There's nothing. He just does it. There's no mention of his betrayal. There's no nothing. He just jumps in. His fear and doubt are gone. He is all in to start the work. The other disciples, continuing the story, came in the boat dragging, and it's a great Greek word for dragging heavy stuff, dragging the net full of fish. Oh yeah, it's heavy. Even in the water, it's heavy. When they were not far from land, because they were not far from land, about 100 yards off, so they're struggling to get this thing in the water. They're struggling to get it in. They finally get the boat on shore. They finally got to land. They saw a charcoal fire in place with fish already laid out on it and bread. They left the nets full of fish in the water by the boat. They just left it there, got out, and saw the fire and saw that fish was already there. And you think, boy, what a waste of their time. No, because Jesus then says to them, bring some of the fish that you just caught. Participate with me in what I'm doing. It's a beautiful moment in the text of join with me. Yeah, Jesus says, I can do it on my own, but I want you to help. You bring some of the fish you caught, and we'll share in a community. Jesus already has fished, and they're already cooked. Participation, co-laborers. So the story continues. So Simon Peter went aboard and hauled the net ashore. What did we heard about this net? It's heavy. Several people are struggling to get it just to the water. And Simon Peter hauls the net ashore full of large fish. No smelts here. These are fish. 153 of them. And although there were so many, the net was not torn. What do you picture? What I picture is the last scene in the cartoon, The Grinch Who Stole Christmas, where he picks up the sleigh over his head. This is Super Peter. That's the point. They're telling you it's in the water, and this one guy goes and drags it all by himself. Super Peter. He's the guy we want to emulate. He doesn't bring some of the fish. He brings them all. Oh, Peter. Always Peter. He brings them all. He is that enthusiastic. He drags the whole net on shore by himself. He is fully engaged in this plan, in this task, in this process, fully participating and taking the lead with no snide comments, no hesitancy, just willing obedience above and beyond the call of duty. Here is really willing obedience. No resistant obedience, this is a willing obedience. Jesus said to them, I can hear him chuckling at Peter, come, have some breakfast. Yeah, we'll eat. The movie Babe, at the very end with the little pig, the farmer, and the pig does all this wonderful stuff. Remember what the farmer says? That'll do, pig. That'll do. That's what I hear in Jesus' comment here. That'll do. You've done good. Come, sit down. Let's have some breakfast. Well done. You can almost hear Jesus smiling at the successful transformation of his disciples, especially Jesus. Now, no one dared ask him, who are you? They knew it was the Lord. All are now sure of what John and Peter knew. All disciples, all readers of this gospel are to know that Jesus is the Lord, and those who know it share in the community meal with him. We call it Lord's Supper. Do you see how nice and summation this chapter is becoming? And then, this was the third time that Jesus was revealed to his disciples after he was raised from the dead. Mary at the tomb, the disciples in the room with Thomas, and now at the seashore. It's simply a summary of what we've already seen in the book so far. So what changed in Peter from Luke's introduction of him in chapter 5 of Luke to the rooster, to the empty tomb, to Super Peter at the seashore? Let's continue the story. Finish up chapter 21. When they had finished breakfast, Jesus, I don't know what they talked about, but when they finished breakfast, Jesus said to Simon Peter, Simon, and we're all familiar with this passage. It's often preached separately. Simon, son of John, do you love me more than these? Does that mean, do you love me more than they do, or do you love me more than you love them? Scholars are split. Regardless, he said to him, yes, Lord, you know that I love you. Feed my lambs. Three times this happens. And Peter, in the third time, he's grieved by it, says the text, because he had to ask him three times, what's going on? Well, three is the nice biblical number of completion. But notice the change in the third one. Jesus says to Jesus, Lord, you know everything. You know that I love you. And there's your moment of forgiveness if you needed it. This is Peter saying, you know what I did. You know all about me. You know that I really do love you. That we're okay. You know this. And for Jesus, that's enough. Jesus doesn't want to ignore Peter as Peter, as sinful Peter, for what Peter did. Jesus wants to move on. Feed my lambs, tend my sheep, feed my sheep. Jesus is moving on. Jesus doesn't want us to wallow where we were. Jesus wants us transformed to where we can be. And that's the story here. Feed my sheep. Oh my, there's another task. Jesus' invitation always comes with something to do. We don't get saved so we can watch TV. We get saved so we can serve the kingdom. Loving Jesus and really feeling his love, even through an awareness of sinfulness. Peter must have known he was still sinful. The betrayal proved that. And he finally admits as much. You know everything. But now he understood the forgiveness and mercy brought about by love and relationship. What had gone on between Luke 5 and John 21? 3 years with Jesus. A relationship built. Love exchanged, mercy seen, friendship. A relationship with Jesus is what went on. He was transformed by the love and grace brought by relationship. That's the key. And just as Peter is transformed, the placement of this story in John's epilogue drives home the point that all the readers of John's gospel are supposed to be similarly transformed by relationship with Jesus. Additionally, just as in Luke's gospel, there's a task that comes with the transformed relationship. For Luke, it was the task of beginning. Capture these people. John also has a task, but notice what this task is. Care for the people you've captured. Continuing the service. It's not just about evangelism. It's about transformation. It's about helping people to live in relationship with Jesus. You got to get them there first. But once you get them, that's just the start. The rest is a life lived in relationship that brings about transformation through love and grace. Always remembering they are the Lord's sheep, not ours. Feed my sheep. Feed my lambs. Care for my people. There's one aspect left in Luke's story that must find its way into John's in order to finish the story. How did Luke's story end? They dropped their nets, and what did they do? Followed. I'll bet we find it here. Verse 18, continuing the story. Truly, truly, I say to you, when you were young, Jesus talking to Peter, you used to dress yourself and walk wherever you wanted, but when you are old, you will stretch out your hands and another will dress you and carry you where you do not wish to go. Parenthetically, this he said to show by what kind of death he was to glorify God. And after saying that, Jesus says, follow me. Knowing full well where following will get you, follow anyway. Follow even to death. Peter notes that the life of a fully committed disciple will have persecution even to death, but the call is still to follow. Just as it was in Luke, only here the call to follow is made with full knowledge that Jesus went to his death and we follow him there. Yes, we. Again, the epilogue is not written about the characters so much as it's written to the readers. Us, every reader who reads this gospel, this is the point that John is trying to make. You are that other unnamed disciple in the boat. You've always been there. Will you follow? Will you pull in the net? Will you join with Super Peter? Will you live a life being transformed through ongoing relationship with the Son of God? So one story at the beginning of Luke's gospel and one story at the end of John's. What can we learn from these two? We can see a transformation in Peter, perhaps as a model to all of us. I think we see this transformation in four things. Resistant obedience becomes willing obedience, beyond willing. Fear, because of our own sinfulness, becomes loving Jesus even through an awareness of our ongoing sinful nature. Catching humans becomes caring for the community built by those caught humans. Following Jesus, well, actually, that never becomes anything else. Relationship will deepen, understanding will deepen, but we are always to follow. Transformation in us comes through knowing Jesus and having been with him. Relationship, not theology or even praxis. In honest relationship, we can be aware of our shortcomings, but we are also aware of God's love for us and his grace. Final movie reference. In the movie As Good As It Gets, the very damaged lead character says of his relationship with the female lead, "She makes me want to be a better man." Through his relationship with Jesus, Peter became a better person. Peter wanted to become something better because of the love that Jesus showed him. Forgiven and a more complete and connected version of Peter, he never really stops being Peter. More the man that God always wanted him to be. John calls all of us to that same transformation through relationship with Christ. Are we being transformed from the inside out? Is our relationship with Jesus real and honest enough to make us the better person that God wants us to be? I pray it does. Would you pray? Gracious God, we thank you for the opportunity to relate to you in life. We thank you that as we grow close to you, we become more like you, that we become the people that you want us to be. And we ask that we would always be aware of your guiding hand and your "do not be afraid." May we move together from this place, not in fear, but in boldness, in willingness, transforming our lives and helping those around us to transform theirs. In Jesus' name.